Hello, everybody. Welcome to the No Brain Podcast. I'm here today with an incredible producer, an incredible photographer, and his name is Aaron McKenzie. Aaron, thank you for making the time to share with me on the No Breaking Podcast today.
Hey, thanks for having me, James. I hope I can live up to the incredible description there.
Look, you're already living up to it in my eyes, and I think that's probably the only one that counts. Maybe my mum's too, because she's the only other listener we have. But that, I'm sure, is an absolute without certainty 100% true.
Well, I was always told that if your mom tells you she loves you, you better get a second opinion or check her sources.
Then I'm going to probably have to defer to my father. So I think that he's okay. He's going to back her up on that one.
All right. Well, I'm happy to be here.
Well, so speaking of that then, Aaron, so how did you sort of fall into this world of automotive? I mean, where did it sort of come from with you originally? And then sort of how did it sort of come into play in regards to this later part of your life?
That's a weird life trajectory there. I don't think I would be accused of having a plan. I was an English lit major in college, and took off to South Korea shortly after I graduated. Just wanted to see the world and get paid to travel rather than spend all my money I didn't have anyway. And yep. So I got a job teaching English over there. This was about 20 years ago almost now, and that was just the easiest job to get for a college graduate, and I did that for a few years, and then I did graduate school over there. I just was really fascinated with South Korea and the change in the economy, and I think also living next to North Korea is never boring as well. And so I went to grad school and studied economic development, really focused on Northeast Asia, mm-hmm. and just figured that that's what I would do. I thought I'd go get my PhD in economics, and really quickly found out that me and academia just did not get along very well, but, you know, kind of continued working in that world for a little bit. But not too long after moving back to the States in 2013, I got connected with the folks who ran Petrolicious. This was late 2013, I guess. They'd been around for probably about a year, I suppose. Mm-hmm. And maybe a year and a half at that point, and ended up being their in-house producer for a couple years until, I guess, about mid-2016, I suppose. And then at that point, I left Petrolicious and have been running my own production company / creative studio ever since. And, you know, these days, photography and producing really takes up most of my time, and I would say that's about 80-90% automotive. But it was really... You know, I didn't come back to the States from Korea thinking, oh, I'm going to go work in media or I'm going to go work in automotive. I had no background in either of those. And it was just accidentally stumbling into that and just carving out a niche for myself, I suppose. And I think it was just a case of admitting that you don't know anything, start from the bottom, and you realize you might have a knack for something that you had never even been exposed to before.
So how did you sort of get connected with the guys at Petrolicious? Was it just sort of connected friends, so to speak?
No, because certainly when I moved to the States from Korea, I grew up in Oregon and had kind of bounced around during college, but really whatever social connections I had were in Oregon. And thereafter, I lived in South Korea for 10 years, I guess. And so at that point, there wasn't really much of a social network anywhere. And so when I came to Southern California, first Orange County and then LA, I didn't really know anyone at all. And so I'm trying to remember how exactly I ended up in their office. I don't remember if I was a reader of the site, and they may have posted the job, or I may have met someone who referred me over there. I'm having trouble remembering right now, truth be told, but I think I applied or talked to them initially about a job as an editor on their, the written side, the editorial side, but ended up that they felt like they needed someone to kind of run projects on the video side. And so that's what I ended up doing.
So what were some of the projects then you ended up helping them and sort of run with there at Petrolicious when you started there back in 2013?
When I started there, right around probably early 2014, January 2014, and they were just kicking off a project with Ferrari North America to celebrate the anniversary. It would have been the 60th anniversary, I believe, of the North American racing team. And so that we under that umbrella, we did a really fun video with Derek Hill driving his dad, Phil Hill's Ferrari 250 GTO. We shot that up in Oregon. There was We did some really fun one a couple years later with Sterling Moss and the Millimelia 722. There was a lot of them in there. I grew up with family. My aunt and uncle were kind of connected to the Riverside Raceway world when that racetrack still existed. And so I used to go there with my uncle, and you'd see Hurley Haywood or John Morton or Jochen Moss driving, and to be able to work with those guys 25, 30 years later was surreal.
Yeah, I could certainly imagine. So for those of people like myself that don't really know what a producer does and just see the word producer up on screen a lot, can you sort of break it down as to what you do with like a typical for a shoot, what it sort of entail and how that sort of fits in with your work in regards to that?
Sure. So the larger the budgets on any project get, the more producers you'll have and the more that division of labor really gets divided among those people. So there's everything from, the line producers who are really kind of dealing with a lot of the nuts and bolts and, making sure the crew is there and the budget's on point and all that stuff. And then there's sort of more creative producers who are working with the director or the creative team to dial in the look and the feel and the themes of the project. And so that's when you have a big project, there can be a lot of producers doing different things. At the smaller end of things, certainly say like a Petrolicious project, or even a lot of stuff that happens now when the budgets have just been carved up so much, a producer has to wear a lot of hats. And so I tend to work on the creative side really heavily with the director in terms of either writing scripts or working on the edit, supervising the edit, a lot of that kind of creative type of stuff, all the way over to, literally sitting with spreadsheets for hours on end trying to make budgets work. It's all of those things in between. So it really, you kind of have to know a little about a lot of things, and it keeps you on your toes. It's project management is really what it is at the end of the day for what I do.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'd imagine you'd be juggling a lot of things throughout the whole premise of it.
You are, and if you're the type of person who likes variety, it's a great position. I mean, I think the creative world in general can be that, but it is a lot of variety. And so there's there's the creative side, sometimes you are the person coming up with the project, and sometimes you're just helping someone execute it, and sometimes you're the one writing the checks or making the numbers work on a spreadsheet. And so that part of it I actually really enjoy, because no 2 days are the same.
I was going to say, you're probably also the one that's kind of praying for clear skies as well at the end of the day.
Oh, my goodness. Yes. Although praying for clear skies, but then also I think as photographers, we always love clouds, nature's softbox, but you just want the right kind of clouds. You don't want them threatening rains. And so you get very picky about these things, right?
Yeah, I was going to say, a few of those Simpsons clouds and you're good to go.
Exactly, but you want them at the right time. You don't want them blocking the sun and then, screwing up your light and then coming back harsh light. And so we're very picky about these things.
So speaking of that, then how does you sort of fall into the photography aspect of it all as well? How did that sort of come into play?
When I was growing up, my dad was kind of into photography. We didn't really have any money to speak of, but he somehow had cameras sitting around. And so we have, old Super 8 home movies of my sister and I, and we have a huge boxes of slides and photos that my dad took. And as a kid, I always was curious about the cameras, but for whatever reason, didn't learn a ton about them from my dad. And then when I got back into the production world, it was just one of those situations where I found myself hiring photographers all the time. And I have this idea in my head that we should all try to add one new skill to our toolbox every year. And you don't have to become an expert. Give yourself permission to not become an expert. Just learn the basics. Just become competent in it. And so at some point, I don't know, 5 years ago or so, I just said, okay, I need to learn to use a camera to some competent level. And I think I just went on Udemy or some site like that and just started taking tutorials of like, how does a camera work? And from there, you can teach the technical skills, and from there you either have a point of view or you don't. You either have ideas you want to communicate or you don't. You can't teach that stuff, but the technical side of it is pretty easy to learn. And it was just a case of I had a need that I wanted to fill, and I felt like that's a skill I should have. It's applicable to my life. And so that's really right around 2018, early 2019 is where not to say that I don't still hire photographers, but I do a lot more of it myself now.
Yeah, and I'm imagining as well that having the access to those shoots and the kind of things where you go is also be helpful in getting your creative juices flowing as well, seeing something from another perspective.
For sure. And then there's some projects, for example, we have a series that we shoot for Nitto Tire called On the Trail, and it's all in the backcountry. It's all off-road stuff. And the budgets are one reason that we keep the crew small, but even more than that, it's simply space. You know, we're going out there with three Jeeps maybe, and there's just not a lot of space, and there's not even room for a sound guy. And so, you know, the director and the camera guy have to also run sound, and there's not room for another photographer. And so as the producer, it's very helpful if I can then cover that as well, just because there's no space, there's no ability to take a large crew out there.
Yeah. So speaking of that, then, so after your few years at Petrolicious, where did you sort of go back? We take a step back and look at that in your trajectory and where you sort of ended up to where you are today.
Well, around the time I felt like it was just time to leave Petrolicious, I felt like I'd learned what I could learn there. I didn't feel like I was giving them anything new. I didn't feel like I was learning a lot. It just, you know, it was just one of those things where it's time to move on. It wasn't acrimonious or anything, but I felt like, you know what, I don't exactly know what the next step is, but I just at that point, I felt like, you know, I have enough contacts. I kind of have a sense of how the industry works. I think I can make this work. And so I just leaped, or I took the leap, I should say, and started doing work with brands like Haggerty, whom I still work with today, and Pelote Shoes, had contacts at places like that, and we just started working together, started producing or working with friends and colleagues to produce their projects. So, you know, a friend might have a Jaguar commercial, for example, and I'd come on as a producer of that, just picking up freelance work where I could. And then right around early 2018, I incorporated my own business and really have grown it since then.
So, yeah, so let's, if we could talk about a bit about your business and sort of some of the things it's covered in the last 2 to 3 years as we come on now in 2021, of where you've sort of being able to sort of put your hands into different sort of aspects of those areas.
Sure. Well, what I really enjoy, like I said, it's primarily automotive. And that just is that's a product of you do work in a certain area. And if it's any good, then similar brands come talk to you and say, we like your sensibility. We see you know how to talk about this industry. And, you know, if you want to get out of that world, you kind of have to do a lot of spec work and show that you can do the work before people are going to trust you to do it. So I have stayed pretty busy doing automotive work for those few years. And what I really enjoy is more, I mean, I'm not going to turn down the one-off commercials. They're a fun challenge. They're, you know, obviously more lucrative than some of the other stuff I do. But I really enjoy being able to work with a brand to tell its story. And by story, I mean positioning that brand as sort of a guide into a certain world. And so let's just take Haggerty, for example. They insure classic cars primarily. They have a lot of tentacles on their business, but that's primarily what they're known for. Well, for a lot of people, the world of classic cars seems expensive. It seems like finicky. They're just going to fall apart. It just seems like that's an exclusive world that maybe if I'm not already in it, I feel like it's off limits to me. And one of the things that's been fun with Haggerty is to try to say to the viewers, no, this is open to everyone. You know, whatever your budget is, this is open to you. And here, we're here as like a trusted friend and a guide to show you around this world. You know, we'll show you how to do it safely, how to do it economically, how to do it with some peace of mind. And it's a similar ethos for the On the Trail series with Driving Line, is to say, look, we're going to invite you into the backcountry. Trust us. We'll show you around. It's not off limits to you. And it's fun to work with the brands on a more sustained basis to tell those stories. And you really get to, you know, build on the learnings to just kind of improve and iterate as you go.
Sure, and it's not just all video footage, though. I mean, I'm guessing it's a number of several different outlets as well, right?
Could you clarify what you mean by different outlets?
So, like, for example, I think you've talked in the past about maybe looking at clothing, liveries, design work, all host of things that sort of come into helping this brand tell its story kind of thing.
Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah, so typically on a lot of these types of projects, I also have found that in addition to enjoying the realities, I guess, of being self-employed and being able to choose your own adventure, I guess, I really enjoy working with brands and being the one to just propose the entire project and say, look, here's the idea. here is the core, say, video. Then there's going to be photography assets. Oh, by the way, there needs to be all these design elements. We'll provide that for you, the branding, it could be the clothing. It could be, if you want a livery for a race car, which is, I don't think any of our livery designs, I'm not the designer, but our livery designs, I'm not sure they've been on the racetrack yet. We've had a few that have been accepted and for various reasons, cough, cough, COVID, have not actually ended up running. So, there's all kinds of stuff around one idea that just needs to be accomplished, So it's fun to be able to go to a brand and say, here it is, one basket, it's coherent, it's an entire worldview, it represents your brand's ethos, and it's beautiful, hopefully it's beautiful, it's cinematic video and well done design, and just elevates the brand's image.
Yeah, and that brings up another thing. I mean, 2020 must have certainly been an unusual year for you, working as a freelancer, working your own company and doing these things. I mean, how do you sort of try to adapt to that scenario and sort of cater for a global pandemic?
That's one. I want to be careful about how I talk about this, just because I feel like I was really fortunate last year. I didn't, a lot of people lost their jobs, their businesses closed, people were sick, people were dying. I was just really blessed. One, I have really good clients who were very good at saying, can we help? And I was fortunate I never had to take them up on that or anything. But it was also after a couple months of downtime, I guess March, the lockdown started. And then by around May, I think we started saying, look, we think there's a way to safely get back to work. We can take a small crew. We can take the necessary precautions. We can, especially if you're shooting off-road stuff, you can kind of be away from cities and be off the grid more or less. So we started tiptoeing back into it around May. And then I would say right around September, I don't know if people were scared there was going to be the second wave as the winter weather came in, or if every brand had just used everything they had on the shelf and for re-editing and repurposing assets, and they just had nothing left. And right around September last year, it just kicked into overdrive, and it's been kind of nonstop since then. It's been really busy since last fall, and I don't know if that's unique to me or not, but it was an unusual year for sure, but I just don't have anything to complain about.
Yeah, and speaking of that, I mean, what sort of projects have you got lined up for this year? If you could, if some I should say that you can talk about, and some of the partners that you work with, as opposed to the ones that are sort of still hush hush at this moment in time.
Right. Well, I can say that we've got like I said, we've got some more of the on the trail shoots coming up. I guess it's probably not up to me to say where we're going to shoot those. We just released the first episode of Death Valley. I think it may have been today, actually. We did Big Bend National Park earlier this year, and I'm trying to think where else we've been this year. Last year, places like Odessa and Duran Canyons out by Barstow, Logandale, which is out near Las Vegas. And we did Colorado, Black Bear Pass and Imogene Pass last year. So we've got some other really fun destinations coming up this year. And I always joke that series is work. I don't want to say it's not, but it's kind of my excuse to go on adventures that I want to go on, but I don't have to own a $100,000 Jeep to do it. I get to ride along with someone else. So those will be a lot of fun. And then you obviously had Mark Jarrell on your show recently, and he's a really dear friend of mine. And on the personal side of things, my motorcycle is in his garage right now. He's been kind enough to help me get that up and running. That's been sitting in a garage for 20 years untouched. And so he was kind enough to give me use of his shop and his tools and his knowledge. And so on the personal side, I've been working on that with him. And so that's between those things, that's kind of keeping me busy at the moment.
More importantly, though, have you started the build process of your Valve racer to compete in his open house happening later this year?
I have not, but I have seen this track he's building, and I definitely need to get in on this. But I've never built a Valve cover car before. But as Mark likes to tell me, I don't know how is no excuse. So I have no excuse.
I mean, after my chat with Mark, I will say that I have watched so many YouTube videos in regards to building a Valve cover racer that, I mean, it's serious stuff. I didn't know, Mark's made it seem so easy and so straightforward, but until you take a deep dive into that YouTube wormhole. I mean, who knew there's so many tips on that?
Well, the problem with Mark, the frustrating thing about Mark is he makes a lot of things seem easy and straightforward. And so the rest of us have to break things a few times and screw them up a few times. And I'm sure he's screwed up his fair share of things and as he's learned how to do anything. But at this point, the guy's really incredible in his ability to build or fix anything.
Yeah, I think when you mentioned the learn something new every year, it appears to me, looking at Mark's Instagram, he seems to just do that like every week. It will be something else that he's just put another feather in his cap of sorts.
Yeah, and he's, you know, it's, I think, if you think about your life, I guess, as a road trip, albeit without any kind of destination, you just want to be very picky about the sort of people you allow on your bus, as it were. And you just need more people like Mark Jarrell on your bus, because he's just the sweetest guy in the world, so helpful, just wants to share his passion. And it's not a money thing at all. I think this is a really important point, is like Mark is not a wealthy guy. He's just one of these guys who is, at this point, people know him well enough that someone will call him up and say, oh, there was a barn fire in Santa Maria. Everything is burned to the ground, but we heard there was an old Indian motorcycle in there. You're welcome to go in there and see if you can pull the frame out. And he will, and he'll resurrect it and build a beautiful motorcycle by bartering parts or by putting sweat equity into it. Like, it's not about money at all. It's just one of these guys. He's really inspirational. And I say this not to detour all the way back to your previous podcast, but to make the larger point that we just need more people like that in the world and in our lives.
Definitely. But speaking of that, I mean, what's the motorcycle that you've had hiding away in his workshop of sorts for the last couple of months that you've been working on?
Well, thank God it wasn't hiding away in his workshop for 20 years. He's a nice guy, and he's been really generous letting me have it there since last November. But something tells me if it had been 20 years, I probably would have gotten the boot at this point. But I pulled about 20 years ago or so, I was helping my aunt up in Idaho, just outside of Boise, clean out a barn. She was moving off of this farm and clean out a barn, and this old mid-60s Suzuki was sitting in the barn, and I just asked about it, and she said, I don't know anything about that bike. It's been here forever. If you just get it out of here, it's yours. And so I took it. I had no idea what I was going to do with it, but I took it and then stuffed it in my parents' garage in Oregon. And then I moved overseas for 10 years and then got busy with work in LA for a few years. And finally last year, I just thought, that's it. I have to get that thing out of there. My dad's probably moving and doesn't want to move a motorcycle. And besides, that bike is no good to me if it's not running. And So I had it shipped down to LA, and Mark's been kind enough to help me get it running. And ever since I got it, I know how it is. People find out you're working on these things and they start telling you, oh, you have to read this, for example. You need to know this about those old bikes. And someone actually recommended recently to me a book called Stealing Speed. I can't remember the author right now. I feel bad about that. But anyway, it's called Stealing Speed, and it's about how Suzuki came to have that two-stroke engine technology in the 60s. And I didn't know anything about this, but the Nazi V1 and V2 rockets of World War II were basically two-stroke powered rockets. And after the war in communist East Germany was this little motorcycle manufacturer called MZ that was running two-stroke bikes. They were terrible initially, but they got better. And by the 60-61 season, I think they were on the verge of a world championship in their class in GP racing, and their head rider, who was also one of their designers and mechanics, defected. Like, he left the country for a race and he defected and took this technology. He had a contract in place with Suzuki and to be their rider and to deliver this technology to them. And he did. And Suzuki obviously went on to dominate GP racing for years, and two-stroke technology just kicked out four-stroke technology out of GP racing for quite a long time. And that's how it happened. I had no idea that it was tied up into the geopolitics of the era quite so much.
Yes, it's funny how these things sort of, you don't realize until you read about it so easily like that.
Yeah, absolutely. And so now I'm really excited because I've never ridden this bike before. I've never ridden a mid-60s Suzuki two-stroke. I've been on two-stroke dirt bikes, but never these mid-60s, really early Japanese two-strokes. And so I'm really curious because the technology was just wild back then in terms of just trying to make these bikes rideable. And so I'm just very curious to get on this bike. And so hopefully it'll be up and running here in the next month or two.
Yeah, that's what was going to be my follow-on question, is how much riding have you been doing before, like, that hiatus between you and the bike where you left at the parents' garage for 20 years, almost?
Oh, yeah, I haven't done a ton of motorcycle riding. You know, when I was a kid, my parents weren't, my dad had a dirt bike when I was really young, but that disappeared quickly. And my mom as most mothers, like most mothers, was not exactly encouraging me to get a motorcycle. And so I when I was with friends or family who had bikes or dirt bikes, you play around a little bit, but I'm not a terribly experienced motorcycle rider. But it's a dangerous thing when you live in a city like LA to when you realize just how many bikes you can fit in the space of one car, or how many bike parts you can buy, you know, that would add up to the cost of one car part. And so I sort of in the last year or two have just kind of been tiptoeing into that world a little bit. And this will be fun. This bike that I'm working on right now, it's a 150cc, so it's small. It's not going on the freeways or anything. I live down in the San Pedro area along the coast in LA. It'll be great for riding around down here.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's especially when I talk to some of the motorcyclists that I've had on the show, they always say to me, James, I've only got one car park space for my motorcycles. So it just means that it's the same space as one car. If I've got 12 bikes in it, I've got 12 bikes in it. 12 bikes, one car. It's the same thing. Just kind of go by that logic, right?
Exactly. And I think the fun thing about motorcycles, too, I mean, obviously, it's true of cars. You drive, like when I was young, I learned how to drive my grandparents' Model T. It was a 23 Model T, and totally different than, say, driving I used to have a 91 MR2 turbo. It's just totally different experience. And it's true of all cars, but with motorcycles, it's even more so because you're just so much more connected to the road. It's just an engine and suspension and exhaust for the most part. There's no sound deadening. There's no crumple zones. There's no bodywork, nothing. So bikes are even more different, I guess you could say. And that's what's so fun about it.
And I will say the other fun thing about motorcycles is the people that generally ride them are always so fun. And they're always so enthusiastic to either make you ride, go and ride with them, or just get you on a bike at some stage. That's what I feel the most about them.
Yeah, I agree. I wonder if that's a function of the fact that the bike world is just so much smaller than the car world. There's just, obviously, let's say the classic car world is a small subset of the larger driver community. Bikes are even a smaller subset of anyone who's on the road, and so maybe it's just this tight-knit feeling of a band of brothers sort of thing, or sisters.
I'd probably agree with that as well. I think there's also two ways to look at it. One, they're just very enthusiastic to have someone else to ride with so they can get out and ride more, and two, obviously traffic in, for example, say here in Southern California is not ideal or conducive mostly to riding, so the fact that they're staying alive and not falling off or being knocked off their bikes is another good reason to be so happy.
Yeah, and I have to say, I'm not super anxious to get on LA freeways. You know, I have friends who commute a lot on the freeways, and I don't really know. It's a minority of them who've not been hit at this point. And so if I lived out in a rural area, you can bet I would have, you know, more bikes, sport bikes and such things. But in LA, I'm kind of happy just to play on the side streets and take it easy.
Yeah, I was just thinking, I just went to get that large 10,000 acre ranch where I can have my own little circuit up. And then I'm like, bikes all the time. No cars, just all bikes.
Yeah, make sure the deer get the memo too.
Yeah, I just figured as long as it's like I've got enough flat space and I can get the brakes work, so I can, if someone, one of those fun-loving creatures happened to want to come and take a closer look, I could brake in time, I figure it's all right.
Well, let me know when you get it. I'll be there.
Look, that works for me. And the same goes for you. If you find one of those that you can bring me into, I'm all in.
Absolutely.
So we talked about Hagerty and Driving Line with some of your clients. What are some of the other clients that you're currently working with, Aaron?
Oh, well, we work with a few different brands. Acura is one that we've worked with a lot for the last few years. That one started out, I want to say early 2018, we started doing a lot of their racing coverage, racing content, especially IMSA. So that was a lot of fun being able to go to Daytona. I think Daytona 24 hours, I think I've done three times. Obviously, I think actually Daytona 24 hours was the last race I was at before COVID, and we probably jinxed ourselves because we were making cracks about getting our limes ready because this coronavirus was coming. And I'm pretty sure that we were to blame for the lockdowns and the pandemic. But the Acura racing stuff was a lot of fun. Again, it's just you're getting paid to do something that a lot of people spend thousands of dollars to do for pleasure. And now it's, I don't know about you, but once you've been to a race as media with that all access pass, it's very hard to go as a spectator and be told you can't go to certain areas. And so it really spoils the experience for you. And so that kind of transitioned into working also on some of their broadcast commercials and more the commercial side of things. So But you, what the thing is in this industry too, if you're not a large agency or a large production company, if you get a couple, three, four larger long-term clients, they can kind of fill your year up pretty quickly, and you won't have, you can have, you know, have some smaller stuff around the edges, but those, your eggs, there's fewer and fewer in one basket, which is, you know, a little unnerving sometimes, but it's also, if it's a good relationship, you value that and you want to keep it going.
Certainly. And then obviously with racing, as it is coming back now, that's probably going to be keeping you busy as well, then, I'm imagining.
I hope so. I hope that we're able to get back out there. I think it'll probably be into 2022 before that happens. I think there's still a lot of people just trying to figure out how you make people comfortable. It's hard for me to imagine us going back to a world where photographers and media people are just that tightly packed into media centers, for example. You know, it was always just there was no space. It was just, you were shoulder to shoulder, and just, it was so tight in there. And it just seems like a different planet at this point. So I don't know. I guess they'll allow fans in, and then hopefully once more and more people are feeling comfortable with it, the media will be able to get back in there a little more as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly going to be interesting to see how the remainder of 2021 goes in that direction with events and so forth, and how will it be a decrease in the number of media people, for example, that are going to be allowed to come to these events, and see how things like that go. Will they be needing the coverage to get it out there because they missed last year and they need to sort of make it up? It'd be interesting to see where sort of the pendulum swings on that one, I think.
It will, and hopefully as it comes back, I think over the last year or so, even as racing came back, I think some of the brands that were sponsoring the racing, they were kind of pulling back a little from some of the coverage, if they weren't pulling back from sponsorship altogether. Just, I think the optics of spending a bunch of money on racing while people were losing their businesses or their lives or what have you just wasn't an image they wanted to project. And mm-hmm. So hopefully as things improve, the sponsorship will lighten up a little bit as well, and just be more open to that kind of coverage and advertising the fact that these brands are, you know, pushing racing.
Yeah. And if, Aaron, if people are trying to find you online to either work with you or just see what you're up to or reach out to you, where's the best place to try and track you down?
The first place probably is, you can find me on Instagram. I'm at Aaron W. McKenzie. So my first name, A-A-R-O-N, my middle initial W, and then McKenzie, M-C-K-E-N-Z-I-E. Someone else got Aaron McKenzie before I got to it, so I'm Aaron W. McKenzie. And I'm also AaronMcKenzie.net is my website, so either of those places will pretty much lead you to the same spot.
But I will say, I'm sure that maybe he got to the Instagram handle first, but he's definitely nowhere near as talented as you, Aaron. That's the important thing to remember.
Oh, I appreciate you saying that. I should go find out who it is.
Yeah, look, guaranteed is nowhere near as talented, that's for sure.
I appreciate it.
But Aaron, it's been a real pleasure talking with you today, and I've really enjoyed learning about you, learning exactly, explaining to me what a producer does, so I can now look to see what they do in the future and see where your work goes. It's going to be incredible.
Well, thanks so much, James. I really appreciate you having me on the show. It's been fun.
And thank you, as always, to everyone out there listening. Really appreciate your time. As always, please like, subscribe, tell friends, so forth, things like that. As always, we'll do, leave a nice comment for me to read. It's my favorite thing. But until then, guys, thank you as always so much for listening. We'll see you next time. Bye-bye.